This is a 3CR podcast.
And this is Published or Not. I've got two authors live in the studio, so let's get started. Many of us have been to university, but do we know how hard it is to be on the other side as a tutor, lecturer, or professor? Think of the range in something like literary studies. There's classical, Shakespearean, popular fiction, but would romance make a suitable subject to study or teach? Let's find out with Jodie McAllister and her book, An Academic Affair. Welcome, Jodie.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for having me.
Now, what's your PhD in?
So my PhD was on the representations of female virginity loss in popular fiction. About half of it was about popular romance fiction, which since I graduated about 10 years ago, has been the focus of my scholarly study. So I've kind of moved away from virginity. I left that in my PhD. And now I focus on the stories about love we tell in popular culture and what those do to the ways that we think.
You've got a quote. University is a cruel, cutthroat, neoliberal institution with little incentive to listen to anything or anyone. So how difficult is it to get and retain a job in your world?
It's incredibly difficult. So the year I got my permanent job, which was 2018, only 5 permanent jobs were listed in the whole country. So when you consider the amount of PhDs that are produced, it's brutal out there. It's a knife fight. And so a lot of people fresh out of PhDs work sessional, casual jobs. They're doing a lot more labor than they're technically paid for, shall we say, doing a lot of tutorial, research assistant work, that kind of thing.
Well, to keep up to pace, you would have to read a lot of romance fiction and know about the different tropes. What are some of these?
Okay, there are so many different kinds of tropes. We can sort the tropes themselves into different categories. So we have what I like to think of as relational tropes, which describe the dynamic between the characters. This is things like friends to lovers, enemies to lovers, brother's best friend, or one that is embodied in my book, An Academic Affair, I should learn to say the name of my own book, is rivals to lovers. So this book is about two academic rivals who, through various circumstances, end up falling in love.
Marriage of convenience, fate dating, forced proximity.
Indeed. There's only one bed. all those tropes you just listed are in An Academic Affair.
Jonah Fisher grew up with the expectation of academia being his occupation. Why was that?
So Jonah grew up in a family that was a very academic family. He's the youngest child of an academic dynasty. His father, Professor Christian Fisher, is this big-time literary studies academic, and he's got 3 kids, and he's determined that they're all going to follow in his footsteps. So Jonah's oldest brother, Elias, goes on. He's a historian, not a literary studies academic, but he gets a PhD. Jonah gets a PhD, but then there's poor middle sister Fiona, who doesn't, to the chagrin of the rest of her family.
The black sheep. Now, how would a family dinner at their place go?
Brutally. It depends who turns up.
Well, let's have a listen to page 20.
Yes. Okay. So this is Jonah speaking. The very first thing I ever learned was how to argue. Dad drilled it into all 3 of us. There was this game he used to play at dinner. If one of us expressed some kind of opinion, he'd point at another one of us and say, "Devil's advocate," and we wouldn't be allowed to leave the table until we'd debated it out. Fighting each other was like our family sport. Fiona was the only one who ever resisted. Sometimes when Dad pointed at her, she'd just say no and walk away. And sometimes she tried to protect me too. She's 3 years older than me, and... But when she needed me to support her, I turned my back on her instead. I was really, really unsupportive of her decision to get married.
And what's happened to sister Fiona's marriage?
So poor Fiona, she got married quite young. She was 22. And at the beginning of An Academic Affair, she has just found out that her husband has a secret second family whom he has chosen over her and her 3 kids. She lives in Hobart. So Jonah, who lives in Sydney and is a sessional academic there at this time, is really desperate to move to Hobart so he can help support her.
Okay, well, romantic fiction needs somebody else, and there's Sadie Shaw. She had an older sister, Francesca or Chessie, who loudly said about Jonah, he was, quote, an entitled prick from a line of entitled pricks. Why would she say this at Sadie's graduation?
This is because Jonah's dad has insinuated at this particular graduation, Jonah and Sadie have both graduated and they've tied for the University Medal for Outstanding Achievement in Literary Studies. And Professor Fisher has said that, oh, it would look like nepotism if my son won it alone. So of course, they elevated the marks of this other girl. So Jonah's dad's a real piece of work.
They both went on to do a double degree, honours, and finally for the PhDs, they surprisingly moved into the same six-bedroom share house. Once again, forced proximity.
Yeah, it's because junior scholars are broke. They didn't really have a choice.
What did they think of each other?
They were not fans of each other. So the very first time Jonah and Sadie met, they were 18, and it was a tutorial about the Wordsworth poem To Joanna, a poem which I have some quite strong opinions about, and they disagreed, and they've been disagreeing ever since. So Jonah has been in awe of Sadie for a long time. He would pick fights with her just because he's been trained to argue, and he just wanted to know what she said. He really appreciated her as a sparring partner, but Sadie, who didn't have this upbringing, really experienced this as aggression and mansplaining. So it took a while before they were mature enough to move into the lovers instead of the rivals part of their relationship.
Sadie knew he was a good teacher and, quoting, and he looked like the hot young English professor with his dark hair, beard, and apparently endless collection of knitwear. Well, Jonah thought she was a torrent of thought and intellect and confidence, a bonfire of a woman, gleefully torching whoever was in her path. Now, you've written this book with each of them having a chapter.
Yeah.
The thing about Jonah is, true academic, he's got footnotes.
Yeah, this is one of the first things I realised about his character. When I first started writing in his voice, I wrote these long parentheticals, and then this like light bulb went off in my brain and I was like, oh, he's a footnotes boy, which is honestly a style of scholarship I don't have a great deal of patience with as an academic. I'm like, oh, if it's that important, put it in the actual article. And I think Sadie probably thinks that as well. So it's a sign of their different upbringings. But also it's where he manages to sublimate a lot of his feelings before they can come out.
He hides his love in the footnotes.
He sure does.
Sadie told her sister everything, even about her sexual desire for Jonah. What was Chessie's advice to Sadie?
Oh, she said, just sleep with him. Hate Jump sex is a him. Real thing.
Jump on
Get him. Get it out of your system. Sadie did not.
That didn't happen. So there was more emotional and physical angst from his forced proximity. So you've mentioned that jobs in academia for literary studies, there's not many.
There is not many at all.
Look, sincerity. You know, sincerity is something you don't often link. So let's hear from page 112, because I thought this was nice.
Yeah, so this is Sadie speaking here. Sincerity, my research had taught me, was often seen as a vulnerability. To earnestly express a feeling was a weakness. It was the part of the reason why people, including but not limited to Professor Christian Fisher, like to hang shit on romance novels. There was something inherently earnest at their heart. A sincere love and hope and joy that readers often reacted to with the same feelings. A delicate flower that provoked some people to want to crush it.
Oh, yeah. So there's this job, one job offer.
Mm-hmm.
And where is it? And
this is in Hobart, where we must remember Jonah's newly abandoned sister Fiona lives.
In universities, there's something called partner hire. No, I hadn't heard about this. So what does that lead to?
Yeah. So it's not something that's offered at every university in Australia. It's offered at some. But basically, if you get hired at a university that's a different place to where you live, so Jonah and Sadie live in Sydney, and your partner is equally qualified or appropriately qualified for a job at that university, it doesn't have to be an academic job. It could be elsewhere in the university. Sometimes they will allow you to bring them with you. So Sadie and Jonah have equal qualifications for this job that they're both competing for. So when one of them gets it and they both really want it and they both have really good reasons to want to go to Hobart, maybe it makes sense to pretend.
Amino, married in name only, a marriage of convenience, problematic paperwork. It's also the reason that Sadie and her sister Chess say very nasty words together.
Yes, they have a little bit of a falling out because Chess is not a fan of this plan to marry, for Sadie to marry her arch nemesis on paper just so they can both have a job. She does not think that is a great idea.
Renting in Hobart. Another proximity problem.
Yeah. So my first academic job was at the University of Tasmania, which I would like to point out is not the university represented in this book. I made it clear that there were two universities in Tasmania. There is in real life only one. But rent there is a real problem. Ever since companies like Airbnb moved in there, the prices have skyrocketed. And I looked at the place that I used to rent there. The rent is now triple what I paid for it. So there is a genuine rental crisis in Hobart. And when one of them gets the job, like, it makes sense that they need a flatmate. And they've already been flatmates for years and years and years. It's fine to get married on paper. Nothing will have to change.
As Jonah says, I had survived some extremely difficult tests in my academic career, but nothing had ever been as difficult as sharing a bed with my wife. We have, as you mentioned, in academia, there's lectures and professors you can like or not like. And, oh, Leonard Petrovsky, he's nearly as bad as Jonah's dad.
Oh, I think in some ways he's worse.
The pressures from academia and unrequited love have an ongoing plot line, but there are also characters and places that sparkle. Tell us a little bit about the wonderful wine bar Sister Fiona introduces them to.
Yes, so this bar, which is sadly not real. Everyone who reads this book asks me if this bar is real, and I have to say it's not. Not yet, I would like to think. But it is called tsundoku, which is the Japanese word for letting books pile up in your house with the intention of reading them, but you haven't got to them yet. And it is run by a man named Satoshi, and he is a sommelier, and his brother Isamu is a winemaker. So together they run this kind of wine business, and the bar functions as a city cellar door for the winery, but it's also this beautiful secondhand bookshop. So it's this wonderful space full of good books and good booze.
You have to be smart to be in academia, and so is this romance fiction by Jodie McAllister. An academic affair has characters and situations which are humorous and not so predictable.
Oh, thank you very much. High praise.
Oh, well, good read. Now, just turn just the turn, mic.
Do you need to move the microphone there, Jan? Here we go.
Well, this is an absolute delight. Wait Here is the title of this book, and also one of the short stories in it. These short stories share a theme. They are all about childlessness, and Lucy Nelson is the author. Welcome, Lucy.
Thank you so much for having me, Jan. It's lovely to be here.
Now, Wait Here comes in the middle of the book. Why did you choose this one as the title?
Well, I sort of went with that tradition of naming a short story collection after one of the titles, and I chose this one because I think there is something of waiting in the experience of childless women, different points throughout their lives. It's kind of a bit of a liminal space, whether that's waiting for the result of a pregnancy test or waiting for 40 to kick in when you really have to decide if you're going to commit to try to have a baby or not. And yeah, I just also, I love titles that are kind of instructions. I think they kind of grab my attention. So I liked that about it as well.
In this short story, the unnamed woman tells her experience of going to a doctor's waiting room. Her husband, as a quote, is paying for the 50 minutes inside the room, but the waiting time is free. We are to assume the doctor is a psychiatrist. What does the husband want her to talk to him about?
It's kind of implied throughout the story that there's something to do with a baby who didn't make it, whether that's a miscarriage or a stillbirth or just an inability to conceive. That's kind of left up to the reader. But we're led to believe that the husband thinks if she just talks to this man about it, then she'll be fine and they can move on with their lives, which is wildly misguided.
Now, the grief over a baby's death. Or I also read it as the desire to have a baby or the lack of desire to have a baby. And there are short stories in all of these categories through the book.
Yeah.
In All the World Loves a Baby, Edith's baby is born before term and tiny and has to be in an incubator and dies. But she stays to look after other prenatal tiny babies. Now, Lucy Nelson, is it really true that these babies were put up on show at Coney Island?
It's wild, isn't it? It is true. It is true. There was a man called Dr. Martin Cooney who I think his medical credentials are a little bit mysterious, but he patented and invented these kind of incubators. They look a bit like aquariums, glass boxes that are tuned to just the right temperature. There was no care really for premature infants. This was in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And the medical industry didn't want a bar of it because it was experimental and it was risky. So the only way he could fund it was by charging people to come and gawk at these infants in freak show style pavilions in Coney Island and Chicago World Fair and places like that. So yeah, it's wild, but it did really happen.
It was astounding. Anyway, in her grief, she imagines her child at different ages doing kid stuff like playing at the beach. These images of children are also within other stories. So what happened in the ghost baby?
So ghost baby, yeah, there's another haunting by an imagined child in that story. In that story, it's due to a termination. So that was a much more deliberate loss in some ways. But imagination is kind of a thread that pops through a lot of the stories, actually, these kind of imagined other lives and imagined fork in the road, sliding door moments. What if I, you know, went this way? What if I had a baby?
Well, with this woman, she talks about the termination like a Band-Aid, which is rip it off on one clean go.
Yeah.
But it's not what happens to her.
No.
She starts listening to podcasts and about mothering and learning that irregular bleeding is normal. Was it for her?
I think she was horribly surprised by the grief that came after that decision. Yeah, I don't think she was expecting that at all.
In another short story, I am 5, I am 12, I am 20. Young girl growing up, she treated her doll and the dog like a baby. But at 23, she also terminated a pregnancy. At different ages, she also made other decisions. What were some of the other decisions?
So that story is kind of a chronological biography in a sense of one woman's relationship with her own childlessness. And each moment in your life as a woman when this responsibility pops its head up as a, you know, this kind of expectation. When you're 5, you're given a doll, you know. And what are some of the other decisions she made? That's a good question.
Oh, being an egg donor for a sister.
Yep.
And then she had 2 male gay friends and they wanted an egg donor, but they decided not to go ahead with her. This whole thing about decision how to be a family.
Yeah, and I think in the minds of those 2 men, their family was 2 dads and a baby, very understandably, and she didn't maybe have the kind of role that she had imagined for herself in that. So it wasn't a situation that really would work out for any of them in the end. No. Yeah.
And in The Feeling Bones, a young dancer learns that she will never have children. But she starts to wonder about her other body parts.
So I have a background in choreography, and before I studied writing, I studied dance. And you learn a lot about your anatomy. That story is kind of about an emotional skeleton, I guess. The skeleton is a metaphor for...
Good one, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, then we jump to in Ariel Marvin, I Don't Want a Boyfriend. Ariel Marvin personalising intimate objects. We all do that, don't we?
Oh, yeah. I name my car, don't you?
Now, Casey and best friend Beth have been to Harry's daughter's birthday party. And there's a group of, you know, Harry's a single dad and the daughter has got all her little friends around. And then, you know, Case didn't know what to take, so she took a 6-pack of beer. So let's hear a little bit from Wait Here by Lucy Nelson.
Sure. Beth digs in her pocket for her tobacco pouch and begins to roll us each a smoke. It feels good to do something gross and rebellious after being around kids all day. She hands me a smoke. It's neat as a pin. We stop walking to put our faces up close and cup our hands over the flame while she lights both cigarettes. You remember how every time I had a crush on someone, I used to say how badly I wanted to have their babies? Yes, I do remember that. Well, I didn't really. I don't know why I said that. I think I was just copying stuff I'd heard, you know, saying things I thought you were supposed to say.
Things that you were supposed to say. And then we have Nonnie in I'm Bored, I Love You. Nonnie, she gets cornered into that conversation that she always hates, into the place where women ask each other if they have children. Mm. And Nonnie must say no and manage the other person's feeling about it.
Mm.
Telling them she's happier this way, more about her work and family. But she does a most unusual thing. She wrecks a friendship by misdirect mail. What did she do there?
Well, she accidentally starts receiving postcards intended for her neighbour, and she's so fascinated about this woman's life because she's a mum and Noni's not a mum. So she's fascinated about the relationship she has with her daughter. So she starts kind of hoarding these postcards that are not for her as a way of having a bit of a window into what it might be like to have a relationship with an adult daughter.
Because she really never had much of a relationship with her mother.
No, I really feel for Noni. I think she just kind of struggles to know how she's supposed to be in relation to other human beings. She thrives alone and she wonders if that's okay, and she tries to connect with people and falls short. And yeah, I really feel for her.
you've placed her in a beautiful spot. You've placed her in a beachside village which has all the tourists that come. So maybe we should have a little bit more from page 101.
Yeah, sure.
Describing the area.
Noni has waited through the hot months for the tourists to go home and the quiet to return, for the views to be unencumbered by pop-top camper vans, for the gradual disappearance of ugly fluorescent swimming toys and children's bicycles, for the fading out of off-key sing-alongs and squealy pool splashes. It starts out as a burst of hot energy around the middle of December, children dragging boogie boards through the gardens. But by February, she can feel the family holidays souring, their boredom creeping.
And when they're all gone, this is another quote from that short story, restore the sense of emptiness she has come to think of as her own. Well, in complete contrast, we've got the first short story about two women, twins, 76 years old. What have they decided to do?
They have always known that when the time came to end their lives, they would assist each other to do that with dignity and deliberately. Rather than waiting for their bodies to make that decision for them. And they've decided that for one of them that time has come.
So it's a last night of crepes and then a concoction.
Yeah.
It was an interesting way to lead into all of these short stories. Mm. But I think my favourite is father figure.
Oh.
Grandmother gave Fear a gift voucher to buy a doll. So shopping with her auntie, what are the choices and what did she choose?
Oh, the choices are just kind of a bit of a comment on how identities are already packaged up and sold to kids when they're really young. You know, they've got all these subcultures. There's a hippie doll. There's a, you know, she's got a flower in her hair and denim cutoffs, and there's a punk rocker doll, and the kids are expected to kind of, you know, choose one that they identify with already when they're so little and such beautiful blank canvases. So she goes with a really blank, kind of neutral looking doll, and her aunt is very relieved about that.
Called Mowgli.
Yeah.
The auntie sort of sees all of these dolls and she wants to give them a life of their own and a time. But she's living with her sister in Fear and sees the necessity for a male role model.
Yeah.
And I laughed about the pest guy and the worm farm guy, but maybe Mowgli is going to be that
male role model. Yeah, absolutely. Why not? He's as good a candidate as anyone else.
The theme in Lucy Nelson's debut short story collection is Wait Here. It is a woman who will never be mothers, who can't, don't or won't have children. You know, it really was a fascinating read.
Thank you, Jen.
And some of the acknowledgements. Heather Rose, well, she's been on the program quite often, and Sean Pryor for Whittley Wisdom. I like that, Whittley Wisdom. And I don't know about agents. So you said to your agent, thank you for your sharp instincts, good faith and fearless advocacy.
Yeah.
Did you have an agent?
Yes, I do. And she's in my acknowledgements as well.
Oh, there we go. And Lucy had quite a bit of financial support from different Varuna and many of those. How did you go?
So I work in part as a creative writing lecturer. So my creative practice is allowed to bleed into my work time in a way that a lot of other writers with full-time jobs maybe don't have that luxury. So I'm a little bit blessed in that way.
Both Lucy and Jody have published under imprints, different imprints, but it's from the same publisher, Simon & Schuster. So tell us, well, first of all, Jody, how did you get published there?
Yeah. So my relationship with Simon & Schuster began with my fifth novel, Here for the Right Reasons, which came out in 2022. It was my first book for adult audiences. My four books before that were for teenagers. My agent made this happen for me in a way that was really great. So my first three books with them, Here for the Right Reasons, Can I Steal You for a Second, and Not Here to Make Friends, were all published under the Simon & Schuster Australia imprint. But then in February this year, a new imprint specifically for different forms of commercial fiction. So a lot of romance, a lot of fantasy, those kind of things was announced, and that's Atria Australia, and my publisher is the mastermind behind that imprint, so it made sense for me with an academic affair to move under that imprint. So okay. Still Simon & Schuster, just a little different hat on.
And Lucy?
I'm published by Summit, which is a new imprint in Australia. Summit does exist overseas, but Jane Palfreman, who was formerly with Allen & Unwin and Penguin Random House before that, was asked to come and head up Summit. And so this is only her second fiction acquisition, actually, under the new imprint. Her first being I Want Everything by Dominic Amarena, another excellent book. I think you've spoken to Dominic. Yeah. So my agent, Martin, just kind of got straight on that because he thought, well, Jane will be looking for some new fiction, so I'm going to pop this under her nose, and yeah, the rest, it went well.
Congratulations to both of you. And I was speaking with Jody McAllister on her book, An Academic Affair, and Lucy Nelson with Wait Here. Thank you very much, Lucy and Jody.
Thank you so much, Jan. Thank you
for having us.
You've just been listening to Published or Not on 3CR.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.